This is the continuation of session 3.
Keep your vows. You know, keep your... Take vows, learn vows, take them, keep them. And that's... Then you're automatically doing the right things to get the right karmic results. Okay. There's three different sets of vows, three different kinds of vows. Okay. One are called pratimoksha vows. Pratimoksha means individual liberation. And what it means is if you keep them, you personally will get free. And anyone who doesn't keep them will personally not get free. Okay. Moksha means freedom. Prati means one by one. So it's on an individual case-by-case basis. Anyone who keeps them is going to get liberated. Anyone who doesn't keep them is not going to get liberated. There's 8 different sets of vows. 5 are for ordained people, 3 are for lay people, and you can take them. At the very minimum, you can take the 5 vows of a lay person until the time you die. You know, and you should. You should try to take them, and you should try to keep them. So, for example, no killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, things like that, no lying, no drinking, no taking an intoxicant or something. You can keep those 5. You don't have to go study those 16,000 pages. I mean, if you take those vows, keep them, the Buddha who sees these things that we can't see has seen that if you keep those, you will get the result of enlightenment, liberation. Okay. That's the first set of vows. You can call them like morality vows. Second set of vows are bodhisattva vows. 64 vows. 18 root vows, 46 secondary vows. They're very, very beautiful. They're completely different. I mean, the first one is praising yourself and putting down other people. That's breaking the first one. That would be an example of the first one. So you can see that the taste of them is a little different. It's more aimed at being good with other people. And they're very sweet vows. They're very fun to keep. The more you keep them, the happier you are. And that's the second set of vows. Anyone can take those vows. You have to take some kind of pratimoksha vow or be keeping at least the 10 virtues to qualify for bodhisattva vows. But you should learn them and you should take them. Bodhisattva vows, you're allowed to study them before you take them. Like monk's vows, you're not allowed to study them before you take them. Okay, it's kind of dangerous. It's secret. I mean, laymen are not allowed to look at them or study them. You have to be a monk to study them. But that's the second kind of vows. And the third kind of vows are secret vows, tantric vows. They're very, very nice. They're very, very normal. They're nothing exciting. They're based on the morality vows and the bodhisattva vows. They're very, very closely related to them, and they flow easily. They flow very naturally from those vows. So if you want to know how to stop the lay sock, how to stop collecting karma, well, that's the main thing. You keep those vows. You know, you keep them with knowledge. And in the case of someone who's yelling at you at work, the very first thing you should remember is emptiness. Okay? And I always tell people, you know, if you don't remember anything else about this class, and I hate to do 2-day stands, you know, because you usually forget everything by tonight. But if you don't remember anything else, then tomorrow when you're at work and someone yells at you, which they probably will, just remember, at that moment, remember emptiness. Okay? And so that's the whole point of this class, you know. What's the point? How does that help you? If I'm looking at this guy's face and he's red and he's yelling at me and he's saying, "You stupid, these are the orders I didn't fill on Friday because I left early for the airport." He's going to say, "Where's those diamonds, you know?" And I'm going to say, "Gee, you know, I had to go to the airport, you know." And he said, "I told you to finish before you left for the airport and couldn't do it." And he's going to yell at me. And I'm going to remember emptiness. So what's the use? What good does that do? That I'm supposed to imagine some black hole in front of me, you know, and then
keep me from reacting.
Yeah, that's the main thing. I mean, the thought about emptiness should trigger the thought: where did he come from? Mm-hmm. He's not coming from his own side. Emptiness means he's not coming from his own side. This experience, this event of a person yelling at me is not coming from its own side. So just remember emptiness first. That should trigger that thought. This is not coming from him. Where is it coming from? You tell me. It's a projection. The data is there. There's a red face, there's an open mouth, there's loud noises. Now, I choose to interpret... I don't choose, sorry. Something dictates, something forces me to interpret it as an unpleasant event. And already you know, if it's an unpleasant event, it must have been triggered by a bad karma. That's the definition of a bad karma. So if something unpleasant is happening to you, by definition, it's a bad karma ripening. Where is it ripening? In your mind. In your mind. The data is out there. There is a red face. There is a loud noise. You know, there is an open mouth and a tongue going, ah. You know. But it's only in my mind that it's being unified into an image that hurts me, that's unpleasant to me. And that's the ripening of bad karma. Where did the karma sit until it ripened? In my mind stream. As a bhakchak. Well, how come the bhakchak just popped up then? Where did it stay between the time that I yelled at somebody many years ago and now he's yelling at me? It's replicated in the mind stream. It stays in the mind. Stays with me. And then it ripens. It flowers. Why did that one ripen then? The scriptures say it's like planes waiting at the runway. It's a... really? I mean... okay. It's a prioritization basis. It's on a prioritization basis. I mean, stronger karmas that were particularly powerful, done towards a powerful object like a lama, you know... particularly powerful because I felt very strong at the day I got angry. And those get moved up in the front of the line and they ripen first. And then the other ones have to wait. You know, the other ones are, they're going to come in priority basis. But it's a certain prioritization dependent on the object, dependent on the fierceness of your emotions at that time, dependent on whether you felt later any regret or not. All of those things factor in and create the priority of which thing ripens first. And they have to ripen in order. They can't all ripen at the same time because sometimes the qualities are... You can't have a bad feeling and a good feeling at the same moment. I mean, somebody has to wait. You know, so that's how they get prioritized. So if when the guy is yelling at you, you turn on that wisdom. That's the whole meaning of wisdom. That's the whole function of wisdom. Wisdom is for that. That's the meaning of wisdom. That's the sixth perfection. And that's the moment that you got to turn it on. Under fire. At the moment of heat. You know, that's the time to turn on wisdom. And you think, emptiness. This guy's empty. And you won't be able to do it. You'll screw up, I promise you. You'll think of it 5 minutes after he walks away. You know, after you yelled at him, you know. Oh, that guy said, you know. But at least think of it and then keep doing it, you know. And it'll become natural. And it becomes more and more of a natural reaction. It takes over that old natural reaction. And that's wisdom. So wisdom says, this guy's empty. It's not coming from him. Where is it coming from? Oh, it's my own karma ripening in my own mind. And then the natural reaction then should be, oh boy, I don't want that anymore. Let me stop that. Let me cut this kind of behavior right now. Let me be kind to him. If I have to be forceful, I will be. You know, if he's hurting other people, I can stop him. That's different. But let me not be angry back, because that creates the new karma. That creates a new kind of karma. And then I'm going to have to what? Korwakor. I'm going to have to meet him again. You know, that's the last thing I want. So be intelligent about it. That's wisdom. That's to me. Wisdom is intelligence to know that this is the right reaction. Question back there. Yeah.
That's yelling at you. He's accumulating karma too, right?
He is. Yeah.
Something's coming from him too. It's not just all you, or else he wouldn't have any karma. Is that
it's not. You see, emptiness is very tricky. It's not contradictory. In Tibetan they say gyawa. Shitunya means it's not contradictory that one thing be acting on its own willpower in an evil way and you experiencing a person being bad. It's not contradictory at all. It's very interesting.
So the bad,
he's collecting...
Yourself.
Yeah. He is bad. I didn't say he wasn't real. I said he was empty.
So you're not saying that this person's not...
Right. He is bad. And he's real. He's as real as anything else because he's a projection. Most people would say he's a projection, so he's not real. I say he's real because he is a projection. And that's an important point. That's a very important point. So what happens when Mara comes up to the Buddha when he's sitting under the... You saw the little Buddha, right? Was that it?
Yeah.
And the demons of Mara come up and throw spears at him. Do they intend to hurt the Buddha? Absolutely. They would love to stab the Buddha. But the Buddha experiences what? It's a shower of flowers. Halfway through the air, those spears turn to a shower of flowers. So does that guy intend to hurt you? Yes. Is he collecting bad karma? Yes. If you did not have the karma to see it that way, what would happen? His words would turn to sweet praise halfway out of his mouth. And you would only experience the sweet praise. It's very weird. And that's not contradictory. There's no contradiction there. That's exactly the way things happen. And you have to get used to that. And then you start reacting the right way, you know. And the truth of it is what happened to the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. You know, that's the truth of it. And that reflects the truth of it. So, you had a question.
Yeah, you were talking about seeing the emptiness of when this person's yelling at you, you're seeing the emptiness of that person. But you didn't say anything about seeing the emptiness of yourself. But I know you haven't gotten into that too much. So. Do you find which is more helpful, or you should you be working with both? You just grab the emptiness that you can get your hands on.
Or should you look at the whole situation?
Well, you can focus on different emptinesses at that point. I didn't talk about the other kinds of emptiness. I mean, there's emptiness of your own mind. You know, when you reach the arhat's level, the day that you become an arhat, you will be being forced by your karma to perceive your own mind as no longer having any jealousy or anger or hatred. That's interesting. It's also a what? Projection. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. You know, you will be on that day forced by your past karma to see your own mind as a sweet, pure mind. That's very interesting. You know, an arhat is watching his own mind being sweet to him because he's collected the karma to force himself to see that way. And he knows, by the way, I mean, he's on a level where he's totally conscious that this is an artificial projection created by his past karma, and he's enjoying it. It's nice to have a mind that doesn't have anger or jealousy or desire in it, you know. And he's being forced by his past karma to experience his own mind this way. So mind also is a projection. And then the changing of things, the way that you will transform into a holy being or as an angel or whatever you want to say, that will also be a projection. And that distinguishes the higher school from the lower school. The whole situation changing, that eventually he becomes nice to you. If you keep this up for a while, the old karmas wear out, the new karmas take hold, and you will think suddenly this guy changed. Did he change? What changed? Not you. Your projections changed. Very interesting. Changes don't occur outside of you. You know, your projections changed. When the sun comes up in the morning and the world goes from dark to light, did the sun come up? Your projection changed. And that's what distinguishes the lower schools from the higher schools, all the way up to South Tantrika. They can't handle that. They can't get that. Lopozar Rashingadrupa. They say changing things have to be self-existent. They can't handle the fact that something as monumental as the sun coming up in the morning is simply a shift in your own projections. You know, they can't, it's too much. They can't. But so we've got to be careful not to go too far. You know, concentrate on the guy at work, because that's where you're collecting. That's where you collect. Don't worry about the sun, okay? That's where you're collecting bad karma. Yeah.
The present state is conditioned by the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, the future, up to some extent, is conditioned by the past.
We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it.
Is our will to change the future also conditioned by the past?
We're going to get into that. We have to, or we can't stop. Yeah.
What about as a small child when someone took something away from me and I reacted by hitting that? Now, I didn't know anything about karma or Buddhism at the time. What do I do about that?
It's what I'm going to talk about right now. I'll talk about it right now. Because now you can see that Buddhist practice boils down to two things. You're interested in not perpetuating things. So, okay, we took care of that. Let's suppose we all get perfectly wise as of this afternoon, and forever after in our office, we never react badly to people who yell at us. We understand that it's empty. That's the first thing to remember, right? He's empty. Then you're gonna say, wait, wait, I don't remember what emptiness had to do with it. And that's supposed to make you think, oh yeah, it's coming from my side and not from his side. It's not his fault, it's my fault. I will stop the circle now. I will stop the cycle now. I won't respond badly. And in His Holiness says, you know, at least shut up. You know, you don't have to think kind thoughts of him, but at least shut your mouth. You know, if you can't stop anything else, just don't say anything, you know. And I would say, like, go out in the hallway or get away from the person. If that's all, at the beginning, that's all you can do. Later, you'll be stronger. But at the beginning, at least don't respond. Verbally, mentally, you already did. So we took care of which kind of karma, future karma or past karma? Future. You know, you have you've handled future karma theoretically from that moment on, and as you get better and better at it, and as it becomes an autonomic reaction, you won't respond anymore. You won't collect any new karmas. But her question is, and partly your question was, and it's a natural question, it's a great question, what do you do about the old karmas? What do you do about your big pocket full of bok choks? Okay. And we're going to get into that. That's the last subject today, and that's called Dobshi. So we'll go to that. All Buddhist practice boils down to sakjang. What's sakjang? You know, you do it before the class, sakjang. Collecting and cleaning out. You're collecting new good karma, okay? You're not doing any new bad karma. That comes in the collecting part. That's easy. But we gotta clean out. Sakjang. We gotta jung. How do you clean out the old bad karmas? According to Hinayana, what? You can't. Okay, according to Hinayana, once that perception of yourself doing a bad deed has occurred, and the energy of the bad deed stops and is transferred into a bokchak, you're stuck. That bokchak is planted in your mind consciousness, forget it. It's gonna come back. You can't do anything about it. The boomerang was thrown perfectly. It's already out towards Pluto, you know. It's gonna hit you on this side of the head. And there's nothing you can do about it. They say there's nothing you can do about it. Mahayana says, use Dobshi, okay? Say Dobshi.
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 If we cover Dobshi, then it's a complete circle. We finish. You know, that's all you need to become a Buddha, okay? Because you're cleaning out your future. You finished the future karma. You're not going to do it anymore. Because he's empty. Which implies that it's coming from you. If you only remember those two things tomorrow, you'll be all right. I got to remember. Dobshi. Four forces. Dob means force. Shi means four. Okay? Sometimes called the four opponent powers or the four antidotes or... But don't means force. Force don't means power. Say shito. Shito. Shito means the basis force. Okay, basis force. B-A-S-I-S. Basis, in its most basic meaning, means go back to the basics. Return to the basics of Buddhism. So you're trying, now we're talking about a very interesting subject. How do you short circuit old karmas? How do you what do they do to bombs? Defuse them, you know? It's a bomb, a bokchak waiting to explode. How do you defuse it? You know, how do you render it, I don't know, what do you call it? You know, it's not gonna blow up, you know? You're gonna mess around with the wiring, you know, like they do in the movies at the last minute, and it's not gonna go off. In fact, they still stay there in your mind stream. But they are rendered ineffective. They can't blow up anymore if you apply the four opponent powers, those four forces. The first one is to go back to the basics. Basics mean you have it in your preliminaries. Go back to taking refuge in bodhicitta. Okay. Go back to those two things. Go back to, you know, go back and ground yourself. That's what she means. Go back and ground yourself in Buddhism, the basic Buddhist things. Which are, go back to putting your faith in the Buddhas, Dharma Sangha, you know, go back to putting your faith in those objects out of fear. you know, and that's the definition of refuge, basically. And go back to thinking about other people. You'll find that when you're doing bad deeds, the last thing you want is to think about other people. It's almost the nature of a bad deed, you know. You can stop a lot of bad deeds the minute you start stop thinking about yourself and start thinking about others. The bad deed just stops by itself. It's weird, you know. Or people get depressed. The last thing you think about when you're depressed is helping other people. And the minute you can push your mind over to thinking the least nice thought about somebody else or wanting to help somebody else, it sometimes pops you out of depression, you know. Because depression is focused on yourself. And the last thing depression wants to hear about is helping somebody else. And the minute you can push his mind over to that, then the depression can start to go away. So, basis force is go back to the basics, you know. Review refuge. Think about refuge. You know, go back to focusing on the Buddha. You'd like to be like him. Dalai Lama, you'd like to be like them. Lama Sopa, you'd like to be like that. You know, try to think of those objects of refuge. Again, I'd like to be like them. I'd like to be kind again. I'd like to be thinking about other people again. Those thoughts of themselves take you back to the basics of Buddhism. Those are called the basis force. It's a very fertile ground for the other three. You're kind of getting your mind plowed. It's just making it, putting it back, grounding it, re-grounding it in the basics. And that's the first step. We're talking about what? How to short circuit old bhakchak. Okay. How to get them not to go off. They're ready to go off. How do you remove their power to go off? Okay. And the first thing is to go back to the basics. They say that you have to, when you fall down, what do you need to get back up? You got to have something to push against, you know. And that's how they explain Shido. You got to have something to. There's got to be something hard under you to get back up, you know, to push your arms down and get back up. That's Shito. That's number one. This is a meditation you can do, by the way. And actually, you're supposed to do it every morning. If you're practicing Tantra and you're doing Tunduk, you're supposed to do it 6 times a day. Say number. Sunjinbe. Top. Number. Sunjinbe. Top. Number Sunjinba is a really nasty idiom in Tibetan. It means to rip something out from the root. It's like somebody taking a molar and the root rips out and the whole thing rips out. It's also related to a word for raping or something like that. It means to rip violently something out. And destruction force means there's a certain attitude that if you get it, it rips out the power of the bad karma. It will actually rip out the energy of the bad karma. It's a very beautiful, powerful word. The key here is a thing called gyapa. Say gyapa. Gyapa. It's called intelligent regret. Okay. Intelligent regret. This is the thing where, and I tell you, I have this experience. I do something, you know, light that I'm not. I suppose I'm a monk. I'm not supposed to look at girls. I look at a girl in the bus station, you know, and then I catch myself. But in the time that I have looked, a karma has been completed. I looked, the karma finished. The energy of the karma was transferred to the bhakchak, and the bhakchak is planted. It's in my mental consciousness now. It is now with me. You know, the Abhidharma school says that it's like a saddle cinch. They call it topa. There's a topa created, and that cinch holds that bhakchak in me. And that's going to be glued to my mind stream until it gives its consequence. You know, I will undergo some painful thing. And what happens is, just after that moment, the karma's finished, the bhakchak has been planted, and if you're an intelligent Buddhist, if you're a well-educated Buddhist, then you're like, oh no, you know. And it's not a funny thing, it's a sad thing. It's a sort of the stupid, you feel stupid. In the scripture, the example is, three guys are sitting at a bar. And the bartender says, what do you have, you know, and they all order the same thing. So he takes a bottle down and he pours it into the three cups, you know. And the guys start drinking, you know, and they're up on these bar stools. And guy number one starts to shake, you know, and then He falls off the bar still dead. He's stone dead, you know. And the third guy is looking, you know. You know, and then guy number two is just took the drink a few seconds later, you know, and he goes, you know, and he falls dead on the ground. And then the third guy's starting to feel, you know, he already downed the drink, and he's already starting to feel funny in his stomach, you know, and he realizes that the bartender has made a mistake, and there's this highly toxic poison in these glasses, and he's already downed it. And they say that's how you're supposed to feel. At the moment you catch yourself, right after you did the karma, the bhakchak is planted, now what are you going to do? You've already swallowed it. You know, it's in your stomach. It's too late. I think the thing works in 30 seconds. It's too late to do anything. Then how would you feel at that moment? That's supposed to be jhupa. It's this, oh man, I did it again. You know, it's like, it's knowingly an educated Buddhist, understanding all the mechanism of how this karma is planted, understanding how it's going to stay there, understanding how it's going to reach the front of the runway and be prioritized and ripen, you know, and understanding all those things perfectly, you just did it again. And it's that feeling you have. It's like a sick feeling of, oh man, you know, it's stupid. And so who did it hurt? I mean, what's the definition of bad karma? It leads to an experience of suffering for yourself. So it's that, all that knowledge, it's all that Buddhist wisdom you have is making you feel very bad at that moment. And it's not a guilt, okay? There's no word in Tibetan for guilt. I never came across a word for guilt. There's no such word in Tibetan. Because it's not that idea of being guilty to whom, you know? I mean, it's just this kind of intelligent, well thought out, clear awareness that you've just messed up again, and it's going to hurt you, you know, and that's gyupa. That's the force which can rip out the force of what you just did. That's the energy which can rip out the power of what you did. Mainly, why? What's its function? What happens when you? When you know you did something stupid. I mean, what's the next thing that's going
to
happen?
Try to clean it up.
Well, that and you won't do it again. You'll try to clean it up and you won't do it again. I mean, the main thing is that you'll say, oh man, you know, now I probably... By the way, it's very hard to remove a bhakchak completely. I mean, the Hinayana is right from that point of view. It's extremely difficult to remove it completely. You know, you can do a lot towards minimizing it or reducing its power. But once it's in the stomach, once that poison drink is in the stomach, you know, maybe you can have your stomach pumped out fast, but it's still going to make you very sick, you know. It's still going to have a very bad effect on you. Even depending on how well you can do these things, you've got that regret of knowing that you've done something that's going to hurt you. And it's just that intelligent regret. It's not guilt. Just think and regret things, okay? Number two. We'll do number three and then we'll take a break. I always promise people breaks so they'll listen for the next 5 minutes. And then I don't take the break. You think, no. What was the next one? Say, Nepalé. Larn dokpe. Top. Nyepale. Larn dokpe. Top. Okay. Nyepa means bad deed. Nyepale larn dokpe means turning away from them, from doing them again. So, it's the force of not doing it again. All the scriptures at this point, especially Jetsun Kapa and Pabongka Rinpoche, they say this is the guts of the four powers. You know, if you want to know what drives the four powers, it's this one. It's the force of not doing it again. And then they get into an argument with the Hinayana. You know, and the Hinayana say, how does it work? You know, how does all this work? Are you implying that a Buddhist can just go out and do whatever they want in the earlier part of the day, and then when in the evening comes, they'll just do the four powers and everything starts over again? And then the next morning, they can just do whatever they want again, you know? And Tsongkhapa says, no, that's crazy, because force number three is not doing it again. And without number three, the whole thing doesn't work. Okay, somebody asked me about Vajrasattva meditation. It also states in many scriptures that this is the guts of Vajrasattva meditation. You must do it with these four powers. In and of itself, sitting and reciting these 21 syllables or whatever, it's not what really it's very powerful, but what triggers, what gives it the energy is this one. It's deciding not to do the thing again. And that would make sense. You know, if you're that guy sitting on the third bar stool, you know, say, I'm never coming in this bar again, you know. These people, you know, these people are crazy to put Drano next to the whiskey, you know. I mean, I'm not coming in here again, you know. It's that decision not to do it again. You know, and that is actually what protects you. That's actually what stops the old karma. This is the thing that takes the energy away from the bhakchang. It's the decision not to do it again. And then there's an oral instruction of all the great lamas. I mean, I got it from Geshe Dargye, who just passed away, Ngawen Dargye, in New Zealand. And he said, you set yourself a time limit. So you say, I won't do it again for a week or a month or an hour, okay? So that's the third power. You try to set yourself a time limit. So if it's a mental thing, I suggest you set a short time limit. Because if you set an unrealistic time limit, what will happen? And then you lied. You know, you collected another bad deed on top of the other one. So you collected the bad deed of breaking it, and you collected the bad deed of lying about it. And it's very good. I mean, it's like, be realistic with yourself. It's like exercising, you know. Make it challenging. Make it something that challenges you and makes you stronger. But don't go so far that it collapses and you hurt yourself. So it's knowing the correct tension of the guitar string, they say, in the scriptures, you know. Know how far you can go without breaking and do it for that long. So set yourself a limit, you know. If it's something like gross, like screaming at someone at the top of your lungs, I think like 3 days is okay. If it's something like having a certain thought, you might want to try it for 10 minutes or an hour or something, depending on how fresh it is. Yeah.
What if you meet that time limit? Say, screaming at the top of your lungs, and you said 3 days, and now 3 days have come by, and you haven't. Can you then re-extend that?
Yeah. You can do it again, or you can pick. Normally, they say pick on your worst one first, and there's this process of moving up through the path where you work with the grossest ones first, and then you work up to the very subtle ones. And just before you reach nirvana, you're working on the most subtle form of the most subtle bad thought. But start with the one that's most powerful for you. My own experience is that keep a daily log. You know, track yourself once a day. Write it down in the evening. See how you did. This is something very important. You know, you keep track of your bank account. You keep track of your expenses. You know when your phone bill is due. You know, people don't track their own inventory, you know. Yeah, it's very important. It's much more important than your bank account. You know, you better know where your karma, where your bhakchaks are at any given time. You know, you better know your account status. You know, it's more important than all the other accounts you have. You know, this is the only one that you'll take with you after you die. This is the only thing you'll take with you. You lose your name, you lose your body, you lose your identity, you lose your friends, you lose your things, but you don't lose your bhakchaks, you know. So you better know where they stand. So you have to keep checking them. And in manufacturing, we manufacture diamonds and things. And one of the principles of quality control is called where you just tell that if someone keeps messing up and they keep ruining the product at a certain stage, instead of yelling at them, you say, could you just count how many products you ruined today? And just by keeping track, they start to make less mistakes, you know. You don't have to tell them make less mistakes. You just say, could you please count for me how many mistakes you make? I'm not going to punish you. Just tell me how many you make. And then automatically the quality gets better because they're watching it. They start to track it. So tracking your bad deeds is very important. So keep track and make a realistic commitment that you won't do it. My own experience is also that you work on it for a week or 2 weeks or a month. My limit is about 2 months. Then I get stale about that particular bad habit, like interrupting other people with my own great ideas, you know, which I do all the time. So track it. And then after about 2 months, you just get so burned out on tracking it that it's time to move to a fresh one. You can come back to that one later. But my own experience is it's good to you know, pick bad deed number two and work on that for a while. Because you reach a certain point of improvement and then it's hard to do much more. You get sort of tired of it. It's good to rotate them and go to a new one. If you have bodhisattva vows, know them, keep them. We have a little card that we carry around that we made. It has all the 64 vows on it. And it's good, like, check one or two a day. According to the high secret practices, you're supposed to check it 6 times a day. 6 times 64 is, I don't know. But it's hard to, if you're working and you've got other responsibilities. Pick a couple a day, work on them. Maybe one. You know, but concentrate. Concentrate on your worst one and track it. That's the third power. Power number four is a nyambato. Say nyambato. Nyambato. Nyambo means, nyambo is a hard word to translate. It means counter agent. It means antidote. I think antidote might be a good one. Okay, it's the force of the antidote. Okay. And this is where you do something to make up. You do something to make up for what you did. It's some kind of a, you know, trying to make up for what you did. I have a friend where I studied. He's Mongolian. He was sent to Vietnam. You know, he didn't know what was going on. He just got to this country and they packed him up and sent him to Vietnam. And they gave him a gun and they said, you know, and he got into a firefight. He shot into the jungle. He thinks he might have killed somebody. So he came to my lama and he said, what should I do? So Nyambatop, he said, Nyambatop, Mongolians like to eat sheep. They love mutton. And they keep sheep in their homes and in their backyards and they kill them for meat. And even in New Jersey, I mean, they do that. And he said, I know your father happens to have 2 sheep that he's going to eat. And I want you to buy them from your father and keep them in your backyard until they die. Until they die a natural death, you know. Like, it turns out sheep live like 17 years. You know? I mean, none of us knew that. And and he took care of that sheep for, he took care of those two for 15, 16 years. And they finally passed away naturally. But that was a nyambato. So that's a very gross kind of nyambato. To make up for having killed, you try to save life, you know. They say that the, and then you could read scriptures, you could do mantras, you could try to help other people. They say that the most powerful nyambatop is the contemplation of emptiness. Okay, the most powerful one is, and the book says, take whatever you understand, however much you understand. Like if you've seen it directly, try to review what you saw. If you haven't seen it directly, try to think about all the teachings you had on it. If you're just hearing about it for the first time, then go over some basic books on it, you know. But whatever your level is, study emptiness. Why would that be a particularly effective nyambatop for a bad deed? Why would that be a powerful force? Why is that the best one? Well, absolutely, you know. And knowing that, I mean, we go back to the reason. Don asked me to come here. He said, talk about how emptiness relates to everyday life, you know. And that's it, you know. That's the answer. You know. What you're going to do, you forgot what you're going to do tomorrow when the guy yells at you. You know, first thing, think about is emptiness. What does that mean? He's not bad from his side. He's bad because of my own projections. Oh, I'll just change them. He'll be a nice guy 5 minutes from now. Can't do it because they're forced on you. They're not a thing of will. They're not voluntary. They're forced on you by your past karma. But all you can do is say, I won't hurt him back. At least I won't collect any new ones. We were talking about it. She asked me a question. I said, you know, at that point, trying to make him a nice guy is like trying to push a tree back into the ground. You know, the result has come out already. Very famous in Buddhism. You have to respect cause and effect. Cause and effect takes time. Once the effect has come out, you can't wish the effect back into the ground. You know, once the tree has grown, you can't, you know, try to force it back into the ground. It doesn't work like that. It's too late. Once the result has come out, very nasty thing about results, you know. Once they come out, they're never going to go back to the seed. The seed is gone. All you can do is be good with that result for as long as it takes for it to wear out. and then resolve not to do any more, not to plant any more seeds. That's why it takes time to become enlightened. There's no way you can just do it like that. It's not going to work. It'll never work. You have to plant the proper causes. And then the results will come out eventually. And in the meantime, please don't collect any new bad ones. And then what's going to happen to all the old bad ones that are sitting around? If they're in the form of bokchaks, this process, this four powers, destroys the energy of those bokchaks. And I don't want you to think that it's me saying that. And that's why the last reading you have, and you can check it out, like the next to last reading, is from the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Diamond Cutter Sutra is spoken by the Buddha. It's maybe the most famous sutra. Next to the Heart Sutra, I think it's the most famous sutra. It's the oldest book ever printed in the world, because it's important. When you see emptiness directly, when you come out of that experience, there are many realizations that occur to you. Those are the realizations of the four Arya truths. All those four Arya truths, you're having a direct realization of them during those three or four hours after that event. For the rest of the day, you're having realizations of the four Arya truths. One of the things you realize is that you've just perceived an ultimate reality. It is totally removed and totally different from the reality we always are in. It's a higher reality. It's a supreme reality. It is an ultimate reality. And it's totally different from the reality we're in now. If you try to compare the two realities, that one is totally different. Totally different kind of thing. And then your natural reaction is to search for something in this world which is similar to that reality. Because nothing is. And nothing comes close. But the diamond is very close. That's why the diamond is so important in Buddhism. The diamond has three qualities that make it similar to ultimate reality. For one thing, it's invisible. If I put a diamond wall between you and me right now, and if there were no lights reflecting off of it, you wouldn't see the wall. It's purely optically transparent. You would see me exactly as if nothing was between us. And it doesn't matter if that wall was 1,000 miles thick. You would see me on the other end as if there were nothing between us. And maybe you wouldn't even know there was there. If you didn't reach out and touch it, you wouldn't see it. You know, I work in the diamond business. Take my word for it. So it's totally invisible. And ultimate reality is like that. Every object in the universe, from the tip of your nose to the galaxy, has its own emptiness, has its own ultimate reality. An ultimate reality is attached to each object in the universe. There's countless ultimate reality, countless numbers of that ultimate reality. It's all around you all the time. It's always been there. You cannot see it. So that's the first quality of it. It's totally invisible. It's around you all the time. Until you reach the first preliminary level of the first stage of the four stages of the form realm and then see emptiness directly, you'll never know it was there. You'll never see it. You have to be at that level to see it. That's the first quality of emptiness. So it's like a diamond in that sense. Secondly, it's ultimate. In meaning, I don't know if you know about diamonds, but anyway, nothing in the universe can scratch a diamond. There is no substance in the universe that can scratch a diamond. You can split a diamond. Sometimes you do it by accident. I can tell you about that. The boss is real thrilled when you do that. And you can drop it and you can do certain things to it, but you cannot scratch a diamond. It's ultimately hard. So, in a sense, it's inultimate. You know, what is the thinnest thing in the world? What is the fattest thing in the world? What's the tallest thing in the world? What's the shortest thing in the world? You can't say, because you can always cut it in half or add another brick. But diamond is ultimate in the sense that there is no other physical object in the universe which can scratch it. Okay. So in that sense, diamond is close to being an ultimate. It is not a real ultimate, but it's similar to ultimate reality in that it's ultimate in that sense. There's another thing called Dorje Segma. Dorje Segma means if you took a diamond and smashed it, which you can do, each little tiny piece of that diamond is pure, perfect diamond. It's very interesting. There's no difference in quality between the tiniest piece of diamond and a diamond as big as a house. I mean, each molecule of that diamond is perfectly formed diamond. And it's totally pure, and they're totally equal. all the emptinesses, all the shunyatas, all the ultimate realities of each object in the universe are totally the same. Okay? The fact that the irritating guy is not self-existent or not irritating from his side, and the fact that my own mind is not one way or the other from its own side, and the fact that Raleigh, North Carolina is not a city from its own side, are all equally empty. The emptiness of them all is totally the same. There's no difference between those emptinesses. They're attached to different bases, but they're totally the same. So diamond is very important in Buddhism. That's why Vajra and diamond, that's why the obsession with diamonds. You know, if you saw emptiness directly, you would want to be around diamonds, you would want to work with diamonds, you'd want to be always thinking about that metaphor. So that's why we get into the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Okay? That's why it was called the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And the Buddha spoke it, and it's a very, very beautiful sutra. It's a very important sutra. And there's a section in there where he starts explaining about what happens when you do these four. You know, what happens if you're able to do these four, what happens to the bhakchaks? What do you guess? They just go away? Yeah, Don said they get scorched, okay? They get, like, damaged, and they can't give forth a full-fledged result. But they can give some wimpy results, okay? And they do, okay? And the Diamond Sutra, the reason I brought this up is that I've put in here the section from the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and it says this is possible, and that if you do it well, then you can short-circuit those bhakchaks. And the example that always comes in the scriptures is if you had a bhakchak that was going to make you go to a lower birth, you know, go to a hell or an animal realm. By the way, do you go anywhere? You have a perception. The mind shifts, the perceptions shift, and you think you're going to an animal realm, and then you see your body as four legs, and you know, yeshi. But that's as good as being yeshi, okay? In fact, that is being yeshi. You are an animal. Do you go there? No, it's a shifting in your perceptions. It's the same thing as going there, okay? It doesn't really matter. And you are there. Suppose you collected a bhakchak for that. Okay, suppose you've been able to collect that kind of a bhakchak. And you short-circuit it, what will happen to you? It says a headache. Okay, it says a headache. What would be the judge of whether you've done it well or not, by the way? No. What would be if I said, hey, if I came back in 6 months and said, how have you guys been doing on your four powers? Oh, and you'd say, well, number three, what would number three be? You'd say, you know, I've really improved. I used to do it a lot, and I set those time limits, and I'm not doing it as much as I used to. I still do it because I'm a human being, and I still have these weaknesses, but I'm doing it a lot less than I did before because I'm observing the four forces. You know, that's the test. And then according to the Diamond Sutra, I'll read it to you. It says, this is the Buddha talking to Subhuti, one of his main disciples. O Subhuti, any son or daughter of noble family, but that means, by the way, means a bodhisattva, okay? Who takes up a sutra like this, and or who holds it, or reads it, or comprehends it fully, will suffer. They will suffer intensely, okay? He's promising you will suffer if you're practicing well. you know, it's because you're short-circuiting those bhakchaks. You know, if you read the Diamond Sutra, which main subject is what? Emptiness, diamond. And you will, by understanding emptiness, you will, in the heavy moment at work, when the guy's screaming at you, and if you apply emptiness,
my feeling from the heart, that it would always be that way, and it would spontaneously happen without effort. Mm-hmm. It would just arise. And I wouldn't have to always remember to follow some formula to make sure I kept that in place. It would just happen.
Mm-hmm. More?
It would be indistinguishable from samsara that you would just really enjoy it.
Okay.
You wouldn't see anybody as annoying. You wouldn't have that perception. You would just see, you know, people's basic Buddha nature, seeing this deity, see everybody as being And you wouldn't have any focus on yourself at all. Mm-hmm. You'd have a, you know, your heart would be so broad that you would be tuned in to infinite beings, but no self, no real self-interest.
Mm-hmm. I would think there'd be no difference between self and others. It'd be sort of homogenous, but a nice form of homogeneity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's that? No more perception? Mm. Just seeing reality all the time. Ultimate reality.
Mm.
Well, I mean, you have to get into the bodies of a Buddha, right? I mean, there's four bodies. Two physical bodies, two non-physical bodies. That's, they call it bodies, but it's really just parts of a Buddha, right? So the first part is Sambhogakaya in his or her own paradise. Total beauty, you know, every single object is totally, ultimately beautiful. And your interaction with each object in that place is total bliss. There's no other emotion that you have as you interact with each object in that universe. In that
favorite.
No, it's the feeling you get from your favorite. So, I mean, it's interesting because every corner, every little eighth of an inch of every single object is giving you total bliss. You know, like you're getting total bliss from millions of objects around you. You know, every little corner of every single object is just, the only reaction you have to it is total bliss. Doesn't matter what it is, a flower or a song or a sky or whatever. And there are physical things there, but everything is only triggering in your mind total bliss. Every single object. And the point is, when you're bad to one person, when you yell at one person, the normal karma that comes back is to have several, or actually quite a few people yell at you, okay? Because karma grows, okay? But what about good karma? I mean, what if you had wisdom? And what if you collected karma intelligently? You know, you did all these things intelligently. How many... I mean, karma, by the way, is collected always with other sentient beings. You know, I mean, 99% of all karma is relative to other people. I mean, you can't collect it by just... If you stub your toe and you curse and you're angry, you do collect a bad karma. But normally it's with interaction with someone else. That's how you normally collect your karma. So if you wanted to create a big pile of bok choks, that when they went off, they would make every single tiny atom of the world you lived in blissful. You know, how many sentient beings would you have to do that towards? I mean, how many beings would you have to do that good karma towards? I mean, the result, remember, is infinite number of blissful objects, a whole world in which there is not one object which gives you anything less than total bliss. Yeah. Infinite. Infinite number. You know, I mean, it's illogical. You know, and it's... What I'm saying is we gotta... do you want an ice cream cone or do you want a whole universe of, you know, that's blissful, you know? Do you want to restrict it to one object? Or do you want to live in a whole universe or a whole world which is blissful? I mean, a whole paradise. I mean, what are you after? You know, do you want to live in a world where like 10% of the things are blissful, or 50%, or would you rather have every atom of everything trigger bliss in you? You know, which do you prefer, you know, of the above? And what it implies is that you have to do that karma towards a limitless number of beings. You know, you have to figure out a way to do your good deeds towards a limitless number of sentient beings. So, what's that called? I mean, you do it in your... It's here, you know. It's here, it's in the reading. It's a four immeasurables, okay? I mean, it's very important to have that... to have that scope. And that's why they have that practice. I mean, the good deeds you're going to have to collect to get the karmic result of a whole paradise, it's going to have to be an infinite number of beings. You know, you're going to have to... do your goodness towards many, many other people. So it's not enough to just be sort of nice or to be sort of good. I mean, you have to have the scope of doing those good deeds towards an infinite number of beings. You know, and that's, it's not to say you're not supposed to be nice to the guy next to you. I mean, a lot of Buddhists say, I'm working for all sentient beings, but I really hate this guy at work. You know? I mean, that's the closest you're going to get to all sentient beings, you know, is the people around you. It's the people in your family. It's those boring old people you spend your day with, you know. That is all sentient beings for you. I mean, you right now you have to work. That happens to be all sentient beings for you. But when you do your practices, and especially when you do your meditations, you have to try to focus on every living being. And I think one important meditation there is Tonglen. And I'm not going to go into that. And I know Don is I know that that's part of the program here. And I know that in your meditations you do Tonglen. And I just wanted to say that of all the meditations you could do, you know, that would be the best one for collecting that kind of karma. You know, Tonglen is most powerful for that. And you can learn it here. You know, they're doing it here and they're teaching it here over a long period of time. So you have to, you know, even if you're like an old Dharma student, you should come and do it. I mean, you should still come and sit together and try to practice it, because that's the kind of karma that would create that that paradise. And that's how you create a paradise. If you read the last reading at the end, the Buddha is teaching Subhuti how to create a paradise. And he says, if you don't understand emptiness, you can't. But if you do understand emptiness, you'll be able to. And he goes into this long explanation of how to create your own paradise. And but the rub is that you're going to have to want to do it for everyone. You know, you're going to have the motivation of doing it for everyone. If you don't, you can't reach it. You can't get there. Where will it be?
Wherever you are.
Yeah. Both. Okay. I mean, they say samsara and paradise are the same. It's not exactly true. I mean, go stand in front of a car. But in the sense that, you know, it's not really necessary that you'd have to go to a different place, because it would become a different place. You know, wherever you are would become that. And if it's not becoming that, you know, if you don't see your world changing over a period of practicing Dharma, then you're not doing it. You know, there's no problem with the teachings, they say. The, you know, the teachings are not deficient, it's your own effort. You know, if your own life is not changing, and if over a period of time you don't perceive any, if you don't perceive reality subtly changing into something else, then you're not doing it right. And you have to go back and learn more. You know, you have to concentrate. And I'd say, like, doing Tonglen, I mean, what it means is your Tonglen's not really Tonglen, and you're not really doing it. You know, it should be changing. Things should be improving. And not in the sense of just feeling better or something like that, but the actual reality around you should be shifting as your projections shift, as your karma forces them to shift, because you've done good things, you know. So you have to try Tonglen, and you have to try it in the right way. You have to get serious about it, because if things don't improve, then it's not you're not doing it right, or you're not really putting much you're not really putting your heart into it. You know, you're just sitting there and not doing it very well. The test of not doing it very well is that nothing will happen. Okay. You know, and the test of doing it well is that things will start to shift. You know, the actual reality around you will start to shift and become more pure. We'll do a few questions, and then
doing prostrations and mantras and noonday retreats and all of that, how does that work?
It's mostly motivation, you know. Like, you can be like me and do all these major projects to help Buddhism, blah, blah, blah. And if your motivation's not good, there's not much use to it, you know. And I often get in that rut, you know. Like, I'm doing all these great things, but my own motivation is maybe mixed up with liking to be recognized and to be a teacher and things like that. You have to... The main thing is your motivation, you know. If you're doing it with a good motivation, then it'll have a good result. And if your motivation is mixed up with something worldly, then you'll get a mixed up result. So I think... And we just talked about mantras. We were talking about the fact that mantras... Generally, mantras are secret. They're tantric. But there is a book by Dharmakirti, which is not Tantra, where he explains why they work. And it's very beautiful. We were talking about it during the break. It's in the second chapter of his famous logic text, which is the last place you'd expect to find it. And he says, mantras work because of the holiness of the person who invented it. You know, the first person who spoke it, like Maitreya or Manjushri, whoever. And then there has to be an equal powerful good force coming from your side, as specifically morality. You know, if you're not living ethically, mantras don't work. And if you are being good, then the combination of your goodness and the holiness of the words makes them work. So that's basically how mantras will work, and it's all basically motivation. I mean, the most important thing is motivation. If you're doing any spiritual practice for selfish reasons or self-centered reasons, which are always there, you can't say they're not there, but you have to try to minimize them and try to have a good motivation, then anything you do is powerful. You know, so that's
it seems like tomorrow when that situation comes up where
I wonder what time is going to happen.
And you know, and you kind of flash on emptiness, and then there's some like space in the mind. Okay, now it seems like to me that it's real, you know, to sit there with, you know, and wait for the next outburst. And it seems like to me it's real helpful to do the thought transformation teachings, to then go back and think, okay, you know, because it's, usually you, the emptiness thing does come later. It doesn't come at the moment that person is shouting at you. So going back and trying to look at this thing as a karmic fruition, and this person is suffering, they wouldn't be behaving this way, and they deserve compassion. They don't deserve to be, you know, harmed because of their behavior, and, you know, they're teaching me patience, and all the kind of things that the Bojong teachings are about. It seems like that's real important. Actually, emptiness makes that possible because the person isn't inherently that way.
Yeah. I think it's not contradictory. I think, you know, again, that shitumba, meaning you're probably going to have both, you know? And I agree. I mean, the ultimate antidote is very difficult at the moment. In the moment of under fire, it's very difficult to remember. And I think the Buddha, I mean, the scriptures would say, do whatever you have to do, you know? If you find you can't use the emptiness antidote right away, at least, you know, try to use one of the other short-term antidotes where, you know, you just try to think that this person might be having a bad day. Or, you know, more normally the person has a backache or they didn't get enough sleep last night, the baby kept them up. You know, there's always some temporal reason why they blow up at you. And it's good to think of those things. And then if you can, try to remember the emptiness one, because that's the ultimate one. That's the one that actually removes mental afflictions, because that's part of the definition of nirvana. It's nirvana is defined as the permanent removal of the mental afflictions because you perceived emptiness. And that's ultimately you have to do that. In a everyday sense, from moment to moment, you have to use... I mean, Shantideva wrote a whole book of short-term tricks for a reason. It's because we need them. You know, and you can use them both. You have to use them both. Because you can't do an emptiness meditation every time someone at work says something bad to you. And if you're working in an office like mine, because you won't have time, you know. Any other?
Absolutely, we confuse with desire. Mm-hmm. You're saying that if you have a desire to an object, the way you show your desire to the object is giving its meaning. Mm-hmm. I mean, like money, you want to make money, give money. And you still don't see the connection between having a desire for something can be, how it is wrong or something, you know, like...
Yeah, right.
Why is it...
I think it's a really good question, because normally Buddhists think that they shouldn't have any desires at all. And every time they want something, whether it's from an ice cream to a house, or to a race, they think they're somehow being dirty, you know, or somehow it's wrong to want something nice. And that's not the point, you know. That's why we talked about paradise. Paradise is is all nice things, you know. I mean, what drives you to practice Buddhism is the wish that you and all the people around you could reach some place where there was no more suffering and where everything was blissful. And you can get there, and that's the whole point of Buddhism. So what are you going to do when you're in that Buddha paradise and everything is blissful? You're going to feel guilty about enjoying it, you know? I mean, it's not like that. What drives us is what Don said at the beginning. What drives everyone is the wish for happiness. You're driven. That's why you woke up this morning. That's why you bothered to get out of bed. That's why you put your legs on the floor. You know, you were hoping that something would happen today that would bring you more happiness. That's my lama used to sit. I had a Mongolian lama who we would sit at the side of this busy highway in New Jersey, and he'd say, "Think about each person in each car driving to something they think is going to make them feel better than what they came from, you know. That's why they're going. That's why there's this traffic on this highway. Every person is seeking something that makes them happier than where they're coming from, you know. And that's why they're traveling, you know. So everybody, it's a real subtle thing between not desiring something in a wrong way and in wanting happiness. You should want happiness. You have to be driven. Renunciation is being fed up with not being happy. But the only wrong kind of desire is where what we talked about. You know, you misperceive the object. You think you can obtain that object by doing something harmful, especially. You know, if you want to obtain beautiful objects, give beauty to other people. It's the only way. Why? As you see yourself giving beauty to other people, it plants a bokchak in your mind. It comes along, and then finally it flowers, and you see yourself receiving beauty. That's the nature of bokchak. It's very interesting. You know, it's giving that makes you perceive getting. It's very interesting. It's the perception of giving that creates a karmic seed that eventually forces you to see someone piling things on you. You know, and that's the whole trick. You know, so it's the perception of giving or satisfying someone else's needs that plants the karma that gives you the ultimate perception of receiving. It's very weird, you know. And that's the only way to get rich. You know, it's the only way to get what you want. It's not just a way. The other ways don't work. I mean, a stewardess came up to you, "I'm going to go to the airport in an hour," right? And a stewardess stands at the top of the stairs and says, "You know, Mr. Roach, I have to inform you before you get on the plane that we haven't figured out what makes it fly. You know, sometimes it flies and sometimes it falls down. You know, we haven't really got it down yet. I mean, we're really getting better at it, but, you know, like a certain percent of the time it's going to fall down. We didn't figure out what causes it yet to fly. Just come in and sit down and put on your seatbelt," you know, and you say, "Crazy." You say, "I'm getting out of here," you know, and you run back to Don Brown's house, you know. But the actions that we take in our everyday life to obtain what we want are exactly the same. They don't have any connection to getting them. There's no relation to getting them. You know, the normal activities you undertake to get anything are totally deluded. They have no connection to getting them. And I always talk about the example, you know, I'm a diamond buyer. So as you buy a diamond, you're supposed to talk to the guy and say, he brings you a $1,000 diamond, and I do this all day, 30,000 diamonds a day. And the guy says, "This diamond's worth $1,000. And you know it's worth $1,000. And you say, "It's only worth $600. You know, I'll give you $500. And then he'll say, "No, give me $800. And you say, no, I'll give you $750. And then he says, no, it's not worth. And there's this desire that you have to be very convincing with the guy, you know. Like if you can convince him that there's something wrong with the diamond and it's not really worth $1,000, then ultimately he'll give it to you. Suppose he does. You know, suppose I'm very convincing. And he gives up and he says, okay, $800. You can have this $1,000 diamond for $800. And I get it. And suddenly I've made $200 by lying. Okay? I mean, I've lied convincingly. And that guy has given me a $1,000 diamond for $800. I just made $200. The $64,000 question is, did the lie cause the profit? You know, did my convincing lies cause me to gain $200? Is it cause and effect? It appears to be cause and effect. You know, is that cause and effect? Is it airtight? By the way, science also agrees that every time I replicate an experiment exactly the same, the results should be exactly the same. Every time I have the same experimental conditions, I should get exactly the same result. That's a clue for the answer, okay? That's a clue. Okay, I ask you again, did my convincing lies make me $200?
No.
No, why not?
Separate.
They don't always work, okay? It's the plane that sometimes flies and doesn't fly. It's not why it's flying. You know, if convincing lies were the cause of the $200, they should always work. I mean, no one would say anything else. We live like that. We live in some kind of foolishness, you know. But if convincing lies made me the $200, then the next day when that other guy comes, my convincing lie should make me exactly the same percentage, 20%, you know. But what's your experience of life? It's not true. Sometimes a convincing lie gets you a big punch in the head, you know. You know? I mean, it's not cause and effect. It's that simple. It is not cause and effect. Is it apparently cause and effect?
So what you're saying, basically, is that making the $200 is not the result of a lie.
Not at all.
It's the result of past karma.
Absolutely.
And somewhere down the line, you're going to lose somewhere between $200,000.
Yeah. No, really, that's it. Exactly. They're going like this. You know, it's two things like this. They look to be cause and effect because they're simultaneous, but really they're two trains going different ways. And exactly what he said, you know, if you make $200 at anything, it's because you gave something before. And if you lie, you can be sure that in the future people won't believe you. You know, people say true things and nobody believes them. People say bald lies and everyone believes them. Why? You know.
So in the present, if we live ethically, we'll have the same results as we did, as if we lived unethically?
In the present, yeah. Someone asked me that question. They said, but isn't the lie acting as a contributing factor for receiving the $200? Isn't it true that without lying, the guy would have walked out and you never would have got the diamond and you wouldn't make the $200? The way karma, it's explained in the Abhidhamma Kosha. If the conditions are not ripe for me to get the $200 right after I lie, I'll get the $200 some other way immediately. I'll find it on the ground. My boss will give me a raise. You know, the equity of diamonds in the world will raise by 0.5% and our stock will, you know, really, seriously, some condition, it's in the Abhidhamma Kosha, it's explained very thoroughly in the fourth chapter. If the conditions are not there, the temporal conditions for that result to come to me in that way, they will come some other way immediately. You know, I'll look down and there'll be $200 on the ground. But at least I haven't done a bad deed to get them, you know. It's a big difference. That's how the world works. If you want anything, I mean, listen to the real causes of things. If those were the causes, they would always work, but they don't always work, so don't get in the plane. Yeah.
Something must depend on how you use the $200.
That's for future. That's for the future. That's fusion. Fusion means, if I'm a good Buddhist and I understand where I got the $200 from, and I'll give it away. I'll give it to somebody important. And it's interesting, when you reach the path of seeing, and you come out of the direct perception of emptiness, one of the things you perceive, it's in that Four Noble Truths thing, is that you will never suffer in your future lives. You will live 7 more lives, for example. You see them, and you know you will always be born in a country where the Dharma is. You will always have good teachers. You will always be physically comfortable. You'll always be in the top 1% of, you know, the people in the world who have any money, as we are now. And you just perceive that. That's part of that experience. You know, it's the virtue of having done that is extraordinary. And you will never suffer physically again. And it's a very interesting feeling to, you know, what if you were like that? You know, you'd know that you just weren't going to ever be short of cash again. You know, I mean, in a broad way. I mean, it might happen in short term, but you're always, because of the virtue, the extraordinary virtue that you just did, that's the way your life's going to be for the next 7 lives, and then you become a Buddha. You know, so that's... Maybe good karma. I think that's enough, and we'll... It's a good place to leave it. So... Yeah, you're welcome. I think you have some prayers you do?
Yeah. Okay.
Sashi Bhuki Jushi Meta Sham Rira Vinci Nyamde Nyambadi Sange Shindu Mithe Uvadi Jogunanda Shiva Shubhashu
Session 3. To contact us on other courses available or for further information, please check our website at www.world-view.org.